Welcome to Statewide, reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. I'm Sean Crawford. This hour, with the rise of technology, our lives are being tracked more and more. Turns out, even as we drive along some toll roads, we'll have a report. Some teens from Champaign-Urbana have formed a rap group. Their message focuses on gun violence and the aftermath. A public service announcement about school shootings is shocking, and that's the point.
Because it is targeted towards adults, and hopefully it will just make them realize how possible it is that this could happen to someone that they know.
Also, we'll tell you about a small town in Illinois and its connection with a famous sculptor. We'll hear how the locations involved in a century-old race riot in Springfield might soon receive a National Historic Designation. And if you think you're seeing more stink bugs now, you're right. We'll explain that and more coming up on Statewide. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Ahead, the effects of gun violence and how a group of teens are using their music to talk more about it. Also, we have a story from the Illinois town of Elmwood about a native son who became a famous sculptor. And providing hens a happy retirement, all that and more, this hour on Statewide. First up, for many who drive Illinois' tollways, their movements are being tracked. The iPass transponder on the windshield can help the state keep tabs on drivers' movements as they go through toll plazas. And the Illinois Tollway is often asked to hand over that data to law enforcement as part of criminal investigations. But the tollway can release private information about drivers who haven't even been suspected of a crime. They get those legal requests from divorce attorneys or as part of civil lawsuits. And as Tony Arnold from member station WBEZ reports, that has some privacy advocates worried.
2 years ago, Ellen had had enough. She says the father of her daughter was making her feel stalked, and he was constantly texting and calling, sending her letters every day. And he would call the police to go to her home, asking them to do a wellness check on the kid late at night, even though nothing was ever wrong.
And after this happened over and over and over again, it was actually the sheriff's department who suggested that I go get an order of protection.
WBEZ is not using Ellen's real name for her family's safety. Once she got the order of protection in place, she also got a new cell phone, new email address, a new car with a new license plate. Ellen put all these hurdles in place to make it harder for her ex to track her. But a few months later, she got word that he had all that information and more. He also had her parents' iPass records and their personal information. And he got it all from the Illinois Tollway.
It's unreal that it happened. It's like the perfect storm of loopholes.
The ex-boyfriend got the information pretty easily. He sued a third party. Ellen was not even a part of the lawsuit. But through the court, he made a legal request for documents to the tollway. It's called a subpoena, asking for some of Ellen's iPass data and personal account information, her address, cell phone, email, and part of her credit card number. And the tollway never told her it was turning the information over. Privacy advocates and a state lawmaker are troubled by how easily this personal information is accessible to anyone who can file a lawsuit and write up a subpoena, especially in civil cases when no one has been suspected of a crime. And while an iPass may not collect as much data as your smartphone, Ellen says it feels particularly invasive because it's the state that's collecting the data.
It's scary when these, government agencies like the tollway or places that have what feels like nearly unlimited access to my whereabouts or my child's whereabouts are careless with the information.
A tollway spokesman says they are not careless with iPass information. They're careful not to share it with individuals, marketers, retailers, unless they are compelled by a court order. When the tollway does get a subpoena, the spokesman says it has to comply. But in these types of civil cases, it's unclear whether the agency ever notifies customers like Ellen that it's giving away their private data. The spokesman didn't answer WBEZ's questions about that. And this information you can get from the tollway in a civil case can be pretty powerful stuff. Just ask a divorce attorney.
Big Brother is watching, and it's watching everywhere, you know, anytime you go on the tollway.
That's Elizabeth Feely, a longtime divorce attorney around Chicago. Divorce lawyers use iPass data to prove someone travels for work in custody fights, or that someone has a job they aren't disclosing. And yes, toll records can also help prove someone's been cheating.
So an iPass is just, you know, a quick and easy way like I said, for a $25 check and the cost of having a lawyer prepare a subpoena, you can get a treasure trove of information.
Several divorce attorneys told WBEZ they've been using that tactic for as long as Illinois has had open road tolling, about 15 years. And the same goes for law enforcement. Police regularly subpoena the tollway as a way to track suspects and investigate crimes ranging from car theft to murder to child sex trafficking. But even that use of tollway data has raised eyebrows. In California, police need to get a judge to sign off on a warrant to get toll records. Joe Simidian is the former California state senator who passed that legislation. He suggested that one way to restrict the accessibility of the tollway data to anyone who could get a subpoena, particularly in civil matters, is to make tollways get rid of the data in a short amount of time.
We're collecting data on millions and millions of law-abiding Americans who think they're going to come and go from one place to another without any reason for scrutiny, only to discover that, particularly as the cost of data storage has gotten so cheap, people keep this information for decades. Their view is, why would we give it up if we have it? And if you have it, then it can be misused.
The ACLU of Illinois is also skeptical of how the tollway shares IPAS information, particularly in civil matters like divorces. Karen Sheely is an ACLU attorney.
I would call it mission creep. I mean, this is supposed to be a program that collects money for when you drive on the roads. It should not be a system that allows the government to turn over to private litigants detailed information about your whereabouts. And to the extent that it is, people should know that.
Several years ago, Illinois state lawmakers made it illegal to secretly track someone by placing a GPS device on their car. Now, the representative who passed that law wants to take a look at how the Illinois Tollway is sharing information about its customers. In response to this story, the Tollway's executive director wrote that he's, quote, very open and interested in working with lawmakers on additional ways for all agencies to protect sensitive customer information. For Ellen, when the IPAS first came out, she laughed off people who were paranoid the government would use it to track people. Now, she sees all the ways her data is available.
It's dangerous that we're accumulating it when there's no protection of it, and it can be subpoenaed so easily.
She says since the tollway turned her information over, she now thinks twice before driving on a toll road. Sometimes she takes different routes to get around. And the more she rearranges her life, the more she feels her ex is winning. Tony Arnold, WBEZ News.
And reporter Dave McKinney also contributed to that story. Next, works of the famed sculptor Laredo Taft are proudly touted by cities big and small across the state. But as Tim Shelley tells us, the little town of Elmwood might cherish his art most of all.
Driving in the Elmwood on Illinois Route 78, signs of the artist Laredo Taft are everywhere. There's a stately museum and a Victorian-era home on the main drag. A prominent statue celebrating America's pioneers that the Chicago-based artist made just for Elmwood stands proudly in the square. Taft was born in this western Peoria County community in 1860. Though the noted sculptor, writer, and speaker only lived here for the first 7 years of his life, it's clear Elmwood claims him as a native son. Taft is perhaps best known for big sculptures like the Fountain of Time in Chicago. But the Elmwood Historical Society cherishes a collection of smaller-scale works long hidden from public view. The story begins in 1984, when the Dayton, Ohio Art Institute contacted the Historical Society. Elmwood Historical Society President Fred Page says the museum wanted to divest of 9 dioramas it purchased from Taft Studios in the early 20th century.
Several members of the local Historical Society went over and brought those back over here. And they were stored in a garage here in town in 1985.
The dioramas gathered garage dust until the summer of 2010, when a tornado with 130-mile-per-hour winds swept through the city. The garage didn't fare well, but somehow the dioramas came out more or less unscathed. But they still needed serious restoration after decades in storage. A chance encounter with art conservationist Cricket Harbeck at a museum in Kenosha, Wisconsin last year led Historical Society members to recruit her for the effort. Harbeck says the dioramas were on display for about 15 years in Dayton during the heavy industrial era before they were packed away.
A lot of what we're picking up is black grime on the figures, but then having been in the garage for a number of years, there's just even more grime accumulated.
The cleaning process is challenging, The wireframe statues are plastered and finished with oil-based paints. The cleaning agents used to wipe away the soot attack paint in different ways, depending on the colors.
One of the challenges is trying to clean things uniformly. So if I go to a blue area, to clean that as equally clean as the red area or the yellow area.
So far, she has finished work on 2 of the 9 dioramas and is working on a third. That also includes restoration of hundreds of figurines. She's completed about 60 so far. Fred Page of the Elmwood Historical Society says the hope is to have Taft's pieces ready for display for the Elmwood Christmas Walk on December 7th. Resident Mary Ann Hanlon sums up Elmwood's impression of its most famous citizen.
Everybody has to be born somewhere, but at first that didn't mean a whole lot to me. But then as I studied about him and realized how much he came back and gave to this community and gave to everyone else, that really brought significance of the fact that he considered Elmwood his home.
Heading out of Elmwood, a sign posted on Route 78 points the way to a granite stone on a quiet residential street, marking Laredo Taft's birthplace. Another solemn stone a few blocks away in the Elmwood Township Cemetery marks the spot he chose for his final resting place. I'm Tim Shelley.
Other notable works by Laredo Taft include Lincoln the Lawyer in Urbana, Fountain of the Great Lakes at the Art Institute of Chicago, the statue titled The Eternal Indian at Loudoun State Park in Oregon, Alma Mater at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, the Lincoln-Douglas debate in Quincy, and the Columbus Fountain in Washington, D.C. Taft also created the Trotter Memorial Fountain in downtown Bloomington. Well, it was 2 years ago that severe weather ripped through Van Buren County, Iowa, with 2 EF1 tornadoes touching down near the county seat. One of the twisters destroyed a piece of the county's history, but not before its image could be captured on canvas. Jason Parrott originally brought us this story last year. Today we revisit his report.
Sherry Dill Billings of New London, Iowa, is one of about a dozen artists who took part in an open-air painting competition as part of the Van Buren County Fair.
I love to paint, and now that I'm semi-retired, this is what I do, and I thought it was a beautiful weekend to do this.
The artists had 48 hours to paint outdoor scenes in the county. Dill Billings and several other artists drove out on Highway 1 to the historic Galloway Barn. Dill Billings says she fell in love with the barn while growing up in nearby Fairfield.
My sister and I always joked around that when we retired, we were going to have a bed and breakfast, and this was going to be it. So this was exactly the farm, which was our dream. So when we came back, I go, I got to paint this barn. This is something that was always special to me.
Dill Billings visited the barn twice on July 19th. Her painting shows the barn at 1 in the afternoon, with dark shadows falling beneath the overhanging roof and a slight purple haze to the clouds. The Galloway Barn was built in the late 1880s. It was added to the National Register of Historic Places in 1999, so Brad Claude of Milton is quite familiar with it. He manages the Barns of Van Buren County, Iowa Facebook page. He says most of the historic barns in the county are small. They were designed to handle a milk cow and a team of horses. But the Galloway Barn was different. It towered about 150 feet above the landscape. It had white wooden walls, a solid stone foundation, and 4 rows of windows.
Originally it was built as a loose hay and livestock barn, and it's a basement barn.
That means it was built into the side of a hill. Clote says that allowed more livestock to be housed in the barn, and it improved the structural stability. But the 1880s design was no match for Mother Nature in 2018. The National Weather Service says 2 EF1 tornadoes touched down near Keosauqua on July 19th, with peak winds of around 100 miles per hour. Steve Kissling of Keosauqua was driving on Highway 1 during the storm. He planned to stop at the Galloway Barn to wait it out, but he missed the driveway. By the time he spotted the barn, it was leaning over.
And then all of a sudden, I looked, and then I looked back, and it was going up in the air. And it went... I don't know how to gauge it. There's nothing around it, but I would say at least 10 feet off the ground.
Kissling says he drove off after seeing the barn destroyed, fighting to keep his vehicle on the road at times. He says it was tough to watch because the barn had been there his entire life. He even helped load cattle out of that barn. And if the situation was tough for Kissling, it was even harder for the owner of the barn.
If you're a good walker, I'm going to ride my little mower out there.
Sharon Galloway owns the barn. It's been in her family for about 60 years. We met at her farm about 18 hours after the tornado hit. She agrees to show me the pile of rubble that remains. Galloway climbs onto a little orange lawnmower with handles instead of a steering wheel. She says it's the one she uses to mow the grass. Galloway drives out of her detached garage, crosses the driveway, and motors past a couple small grain bins. She did slow down to offer a warning to me.
Don't touch the wire! We don't know for sure.
The downed power line leads to the debris field. Galloway reaches it first. Once I catch up, we stand on a concrete slab looking out.
Oh, I feel like crying. But I'm very thankful it wasn't the house and nobody got hurt. I just cannot believe it.
Galloway says this is the first time she's seen the damage up close. She and her husband were in nearby Farmington during the storm, and she did not look at the pile of rubble when they got home. Galloway learned about the damage from her daughter, Mary Dawn Shuck, who drove by after the storm passed. Shuck's memories of the barn date back to her childhood.
When I was little, I have a brother who's 2 years older and a sister who's 4 years older, and we used to play out there all the time, and there would always be cats and, you know, kind of play hide-and-go-seek and all that kind of stuff.
Shuck and Galloway estimate that more than 100 kids in Van Buren County played in that barn over the decades, creating memories for all. Now the Galloway barn is gone, but the family's memories remain, and that's not all. Four artists competing in the open-air art competition submitted paintings of the more than 125-year-old barn, images that captured what it looked like during its final hours. Dill Billings did not win one of the cash prizes for her painting, but it won the heart of Sharon Galloway, who agreed to buy it.
It just looked so realistic. It looked exactly like I have seen it all these years. So I loved it.
And what's it feel like to know that it's going home with her?
I am so thrilled that it's going home with her. And, you know, that's where it needs to be. And, you know, you want the people to have your pieces of work that absolutely love it. And because it's a memory of hers, and a part of their family, that it couldn't go on to a better person.
Galloway bought three of the four paintings of her family's barn. The fourth went to Brad Clote with Barns of Van Buren County, Iowa. Galloway says she might hang on to the paintings in her home, or she might give them to her children. She does not know yet. What she says she does know is that when she looks at them, she will remember the family barn and all of the memories created there. I'm Jason Parrott, Tri-State's Public Radio News.
A reminder, you can find links to the stories you hear and all of our full episodes at our website, statewideshow.com. And there is more on the way. Stay with us. Welcome back to Statewide. Still on the way, a teenage rap group from East Central Illinois tackles the issue of gun violence in their music. And later, is a public service announcement a way to jumpstart a conversation about school shootings? But next, as fall is now upon us, you might be noticing some unwelcome guests trying to get inside your home. Certain insects are looking for a place to overwinter. And I talk with U of I Extension educator Ken Johnson about the bugs we're seeing and what can be done about them. One of those insects I've seen in recent years a lot more of is, it's a stink bug. Explain what we're talking about, the one that people are witnessing.
So the one we're seeing more and more here in Illinois is going to be the brown marmorated stink bug. That was originally introduced into Pennsylvania in the 1990s, just kind of spread across the United States. Right now, it's primarily a nuisance pest, getting into people's houses and stuff. But this one is also a pest on crops, fruits and vegetables, stuff like that. And I think we're starting to now see in Illinois those populations getting high enough where we're getting some damage to some of our crops and stuff.
I think you answered my question. They haven't been in Illinois that long, so that's why I've not been seeing these for a lot of years. We've seen them, what, over maybe the last 5 to 7 years or so?
Yeah, somewhere around there. And then, as time goes by, those populations are just getting higher, and they're becoming more and more prevalent in a lot of places around the state.
I would say prevalent, that's a good word for it, because it seems as though for something that hasn't been around in Illinois all that long, they are. I see them, and I've heard from people in different parts of the state who are seeing quite a few of them.
Yep, so just like our, you know, the Asian lady beetles we get a lot, our box elder bugs, they're all trying to find somewhere to overwinter. A lot of times when you see them on your house, they're going to be on that south or west-facing side that's nice and warm. They'll start congregating in there, congregating on those areas, and then trying to find a way to get indoors so they have somewhere to spend the winter. Yeah, and unfortunately, that's kind of easier said than done, trying to prevent them. You know, trying to make sure you don't have any cracks and crevices, kind of sealing, making sure your house is well sealed up, you don't have holes and screens. Making sure your door sweeps aren't broken, making sure they can't get in through there. But they can get into pretty small places, unfortunately, and get into your house that way.
Now we have seen stink bugs in the past, different varieties of these, I guess, that will put out an odor, thus the name. Do these do the same thing?
Yep. So we've got some native stink bug species. They look kind of similar. But, yeah, these brown marmorated stink bugs will also smell. So if you handle them, pick them up, you'll definitely know you're dealing with a stink bug when you do that.
But they can survive in a house maybe for a whole winter, if that's possible?
Yep. So, yeah, they're coming inside. And they will spend the winter in your house, inside the walls, in your attic maybe. And then come spring, when it starts warming up again, they will start making their way back outside.
So the other types of insects we're seeing, I think you touched on a couple of those, the lady beetles, and also we're seeing box elder bugs. Those have been around quite a while as far as this time of the year, them trying to get inside.
Yeah, so box elder bugs are one of our native species, so they've kind of always been around trying to get inside. The multicolored Asian lady beetles, the ladybugs are trying to get into your house. Those are another introduced species. They've been around a little bit longer than brown marmorated stink bug, but they're also trying to get indoors to find somewhere to spend the winter.
Well, you touched on a moment ago that exclusion is really the best approach here to try to keep these out of your home. But that goes beyond just doorways or windows, things of that nature. They can get in, I'm assuming, in other ways as well.
Yep, so if you have any kind of pipes coming into your house, making sure those are caulked so they don't have any gaps in there, dryer vents, stuff like that, they could potentially get in through that. Siding, they can get up underneath that, so making sure your siding is kind of in good working order, soffits and eaves, all those different types of things. If there's a crack or way into your house, they'll more than likely they'll find it and make their way in.
So going back to the brown marmorated stink bug, which you mentioned is on the rise in Illinois, it's only been really showing up here, within the last decade. Is there any approach that people are taking to try to reduce the invasion of these bugs?
So in like your commercial production, your fields and stuff, I mean, people are spraying for them, they're monitoring for them, and stuff like that. But it's one of those things, once they get established, we're not going to be able to eliminate them. It's just going to be managing the populations of them.
And how big of a issue is that among, agriculture officials taking a look at this? Is this, is this on par with some of the others that we've seen, other invasive species?
It potentially could be in some of our fruit crops, or tree fruits or small fruits, stuff like that. A lot of that feeding damage is going to make those fruits unmarketable. They're going to have pitting and stuff on there. So it has the potential to be a pretty big problem for some of our different crops.
You wouldn't advise people to spray or anything like that?
So, yeah, a lot of times when you're spraying, the sprays aren't necessarily all that effective because these insects are rather mobile. You could do perimeter sprays, spraying the outside of your house, but those sprays don't necessarily last all that long, potentially. And as they move around, they may be getting to areas where you didn't spray. So they're not necessarily all that effective. And then when it comes to getting indoors, typically we don't recommend spraying for them indoors. If people do have a lot of them indoors and you've kind of found a big population, you can vacuum them up and dispose of them that way. But in the case like the stink bugs, the multicolored Asian lady beetle, they have some defensive compounds that don't smell all that good. So a lot of times I'll tell people, try to use a cheap vacuum just for sucking up these insects. You don't necessarily want to use the vacuum. You're using, to vacuum your carpets and stuff because that smell could get in there. And every time you vacuum, you're going to be releasing that.
That's U of I Extension educator Ken Johnson. And as for that relatively new invasive species, the brown marmorated stink bug, we have a photo of one at our website at statewideshow.com. When chickens at commercial egg farms reach about 2 years of age, their egg production starts to drop. Typically, those hens are killed shortly after. But a St. Louis resident, Erica Camp, is on a mission to save them and show the hens can still be great companions. Eli Chen brings us the story behind her organization, Second Hind, and why she's committed to giving the spent hens new homes.
It's a special day for the kids at the Autism and Behavioral Spectrum School in Baldwin, Missouri, because of two small feathery visitors.
We're going to get ready to take the chickens out so you guys can play with them and pet them. And if you want, you can even try and hold them.
Erica Camp, a woman with purple-streaked black hair, unzips a stroller to take out a plump, white chicken named Joe. The kids crowd around Joe and another chicken named Arya.
It is so soft. Yeah, do you feel like now? Oh, over here is soft.
The school visit is just one of several outreach efforts for camp's organization, Second Hand. Since last summer, the group has been helping people adopt spent hens like Joe that commercial farms don't want anymore. Camp's mission is to show people that chickens are more than just poultry. She loved playing with chickens when she was a kid.
I grew up on a farm. Those were the animals that I connected with.
After spending years moving around for her military career, she and her family settled down in St. Louis, and she tried unsuccessfully to raise baby chicks. They either grew up to be roosters, which aren't allowed in the city, or they died.
I had started thinking, well, what if I rescued some chickens? So you knew that they were female, and they had gotten past that kind of vulnerable stage where bad things can happen.
She found organizations online that save spent hens, but none near St. Louis. So camp started searching for egg producers in Missouri who would give her chickens. Farmers either ignored or rejected her, so she decided to apply for official nonprofit status. Second Hand became an official organization in March 2018.
I don't think everyone in that industry is a bad person. You know, I don't like what happens, but it's something that's so much bigger than me, and it's been happening for so long. There's nothing I can do to change that. But if I can instead find a way in to earn their respect and to get them to listen to my ideas, small changes can start to happen.
A few months later, a farmer finally agreed to give her first batch of 40 chickens. And in the years since, she's saved 180 hens. Two of them live in the backyard of Kitchen House Coffee's location in Tower Grove East. Shop owner Paul Whitsitt adopted two hens last spring, which he named Cream and Sugar.
You see the big floppy combs on their heads? So Erica had warned us about that. I think that comes from having lived the first part of their lives in a very hot, humid environment.
Whitsitt says Cream and Sugar's combs probably overgrew to help them cool off at their former farm. But he says they look healthier and they're getting along well with their coop mates, Cardamom and Tarragon.
You know, I don't know if it's true, but I just feel like the two hens that were already here just sensed that these girls had been through a lot.
Camp says it's rewarding to see the chickens adjust to life after the farm.
They get to feel sun for the first time. They get to feel grass. They can stretch their wings. They can, you know, sunbathe and do all that actual chicken stuff.
Being around them has also helped her get through tough moments in her life.
I am a disabled veteran, and my big three are PTSD, anxiety, and depression. And ever since having my chickens, like, they are the thing that keeps me calm. If I'm having a bad day or I'm upset or things are just not going right and I'm just frustrated, I need to get outside and to be able to spend some time with my chickens.
By taking care of hens after their time at the farm, Camp hopes people will see that the chickens can help people heal from their troubles too. I'm Eli Chen, St. Louis Public Radio.
An embattled medical equipment sterilization company in the western suburbs is leaving after years of legal battles with residents and the state of Illinois. Willowbrook-based Sterigenics says it will leave due to unfounded claims against them in the, quote, unstable legislative and regulatory landscape of Illinois. The state recently passed what it calls one of the strictest pollution laws in the country. It was in response to complaints that Sterigenics emissions practices were making people sick. The House leader, Jim Durkin, spearheaded that legislation.
But I will say that it was the voices of the residents and the families in that area were as loud as I've ever heard in anywhere in my time in government. So I will give them the lion's share of the credit for the decision that was made today.
Dozens of residents are suing Sterigenics over claims it made them or their family members ill. The company says it will continue to strengthen its facilities outside of Illinois. And this is statewide. A group of teenage boys in Champaign-Urbana has made it their mission to address the issue of gun violence through rap music. They call themselves Forever My Brothers, or FMB. One of the members, Kay Stubbs, says he and his friends started off listening to rap together before they started writing their own lyrics.
We used to walk home together and make up fake beats or something, or somebody could kick their shoe or something, and we make up like a fake beat or something like that.
On the table, pencils.
Yeah, especially pencil beating at lunch. We would have like rap competition, freestyle pencil beats, and stuff like that. And then I say freshman year, we took it more serious.
The group now ranges in age from 16 to 18. FMB members Kay Stubbs, David Hoskins, Dante Jones, Jaden Brown Gates, and Nazi Ellerby came to the Illinois Public Media Studios in Urbana to talk about their approach to writing rap songs and discuss what motivates them to promote a message of nonviolence.
Really, it's because in 2015, my cousin was at a basketball tournament in Danville, and some people was out shooting, and he got killed. He got shot in his head. And, like, even people I don't like, I never wish death on anybody because, like, I done had so much tragic experiences in my life. I just hate going to funerals and all that and hate seeing stuff like that and hearing about stuff like that. So, like, that's probably why I help out on this, really. To, like, it'd be good if anything could change it, you know?
To me, the violence is really dumb to me.
It'd be over little stuff.
Yeah, like, we all black and we live in a small town and people, they beef with each other just to, I don't know, get their name.
And I'm not saying Caucasian people don't, like, die or go through the same stuff we go through, but it's like black people, we killing each other. Like, why are you killing? Like, it don't make sense.
Right, and I think we really going to get the message across because kids, when adults talk to kids, normally they don't listen, but we kids is Asian, so they know, like, what we going through.
We speak in their language.
And we know now. I'm glad we got ourselves out there enough. Like, I feel like locally, we kind of famous. Like, a lot of people, I get a lot of text messages every day. I got text messages from random kids saying that they look up to me and stuff like that. Or just random people want to talk to me for no reason. That make me feel good as a person. That makes me feel good.
Family too. Yeah. Little brothers and stuff. They
family too.
Look up to me.
Like my little brother, he like my twin. Yeah, he look up to me too. That feel good.
The reason why we advise people into putting their guns down in this peace project, not only because it's going to affect their lives, but it could affect our lives too. Because you never know, like, what if my mama going to the store and then they start shooting because somebody else beef. Or she get hit because somebody, you know what I'm saying?
I think guns should go away, period. Like, guns is really unnecessary. Because once you kill one of their people, then the other person, people going to retaliate. Like we said earlier, it's going to be a cycle. The chain is just going to keep going on. It's not just down here in Illinois. That's going to be everywhere.
So like me, I look at things like this. There's a good and a bad side to everything. But guns, it ain't no good side to no guns. Either way it go, you having a gun, one of your homies having a gun, anybody having a gun, period. Like, especially young kids, I don't understand that. Teenagers our age, and like just having cousins and brothers and stuff that done play with guns at young ages, 14, 15 and stuff like that, and consequences that have happened, like, it's just, guns just not the way.
You gotta think about it. Kids, they're just kids. They'll do anything. They're not registered 100%. They're just kids. A 14-year-old will shoot somebody else and not really know the consequences, because you got to think about it. Just 2 years ago, he was only 12. Just kids.
For me, I feel like parents need to care more about their kids and teach them to not do stuff like that. And dads need to be in their sons, especially life, more. Like, way, way more. Because, like, I just, like, some of the stuff I done did in my past, I know I never did that if my dad was still here. But, you know, that's how it be, though.
As a group of African Americans in this town specifically, you would normally think about gang violence. We not about gang violence at all. We about the total opposite.
Money and music.
Money and music. Us five right here, you would not catch us going down the street with no gun. You would not catch us doing none of that. We normally 9 times out of 10 working. We all got jobs. He got a job. I got a job. Dante got a job. David got a job. Jaden had a job.
Well, now.
Kay.
Finney
got a job. We do not do none of that. None of that. So we just write, and that's about it. We are the opposite of whatever they think black gangs are. That's probably my number one nightmare. Waking up and hearing that one of us got shot. That's my number one nightmare.
I'm not saying it's good that people got shot at all, but I'm just glad it was none of my people's. Like, none of my brothers, we never in none of that. I'll be really hurt. Sometimes, like, I just get a feeling like I got to check up on them. Like, it could be over something little. Like, sometimes I just feel like something wrong. Like, you could wake up and then somebody could be calling your phone like, damn, your brother just got shot. Like, that's sad.
That's Kay Stubbs with the Champaign-Urbana rap group Forever My Brothers. Along with David Hoskins, Dante Jones, Jaden Brown Gates, and Nazi Ellerby, their conversation produced by Illinois Public Media's Christine Herman.
K killer, no guns, just pen and paper. This here might help you save him. This here might help you save her. I speak this out of anger. Eat this like now and later. Papa kids like me, you hate him. Trying to get to the game, no red rooms. Trying to get to the fame, need dancers. Just needing the money, need answers. This next piece coming from Cranor. Trying to live my fantasy, shit don't come readily. Living my life, need family. K killer, he killed to be best I prepared to be filling my life, the prophecy. They touch the guns, they do this with fun. We losing our brothers and sons. They touch the guns, these bullets they run. The money I wanted a ton. Gotta run up the funds. I dance in my
just ahead on statewide, a new approach to get people talking about school shootings. Stay with us.
This here might help you save them. Spit a fact, so please don't play them.
We're back on Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Coming up, some church congregations are finding they have to make a financial decision to move. What does that mean for the building they're leaving behind? We'll hear how some former churches are being put to new use. Next, the buzz of the new school year still hangs in the air, and an anti-violence group is hoping to use that momentum to get students and adults talking about preventing school shootings. Susie Yan talked with some students about a new public service announcement.
The video starts like a back-to-school shopping ad, with kids showing off their supplies.
This year, my mom got me the perfect bag for back-to-school.
But then it takes a turn when those supplies, like a new jacket, are used for self-defense during a school shooting. It ends with a terrified girl hiding in a bathroom stall.
And I finally got my own phone to stay in touch with my mom.
Wow. It was very intense.
That's high school senior Mary Beck reacting to the PSA. She's a student at Lyons Township High School in suburban Western Springs.
I had to stop myself from crying the first time I saw it because it's the first promotional video that I truly feel like I could be in that situation.
Mary and fellow senior Ella Finnegan are founding members of the SAVE Club at the school. It's connected with Sandy Hook Promise, a nonprofit created by parents whose children were killed during the school shooting in Newtown, Connecticut. The group releases PSAs annually, and Ella says people have been critical about the videos, saying they go too far.
But obviously they didn't, because we continue to have an issue with school shootings. And if this is what they need to do to get their point across, I think it's good that they did it, and hopefully it will be effective.
Sandy Hook Promise usually releases a PSA in December around the anniversary of the school shooting. It plays on the major networks and on digital platforms. Co-founder Mark Barden says this is the first release around the start of the school year, and he hopes it becomes a routine discussion for back-to-school time.
Our students should be worried about just the regular back-to-school things like the clothes and their folders and their backpacks and their lunchbox, all of that, not how to respond or hide or evacuate in a school shooting.
Mary and Ella formed their school club 2 years ago. They were motivated to act after the shooting at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School. Ella has heard adults talk about how the world of active shooter drills is far from their school experience, and she thinks it's hard for them to completely understand how current students feel.
Which I think is a really good thing about this PSA, because it is targeted towards adults, and hopefully it will just make them realize how possible it is that this could happen to someone that they know.
Starting this year, all Illinois schools must conduct a lockdown drill within 90 days of the first day of school. Lyons Township completed theirs in August. Mary says she's had drills as far back as elementary school, where teachers would shut off the lights and have everyone huddled together in a corner.
I would be sitting in the corner like, if they come in right now, we're all in a little clump. Like, this is over for us. And for a eighth grader to be thinking that is just beyond absurd, in my opinion.
This year at Lyons, they practice a new type of drill, which students say they feel more confident about. But Ella says drills are only reactive and won't prevent violence.
Things like Sandy Hook Promise and trying to promote inclusivity in the schools is more proactive, and you need a combination of both.
Students around the country are connecting with Sandy Hook Promise to get trained up on what to look for in fellow students who may be at risk of being a shooter, like withdrawing from social activities or bullying. Mary says students are taking it upon themselves to look out for each other and speak up if there's a concern.
Include somebody who may be feeling super left out and because of that want to turn to gun violence. If we can turn their mindset around and show them they're loved and accepted, then those are the preventative measures that we can take.
The students hope that one day learning preventative measures becomes the norm and lockdown drills are less common.
That's Susie Yan with that report. The remains of burned down homes from the 1908 race riot in Springfield is on the path to becoming a National Historic Monument. A National Park Service study determined it is suitable because of its connection to the founding of the NAACP. Mary Hansen talked with the Springfield historian and previous Abraham Lincoln Association president Catherine Harris about that site.
The proposed marking
of the site is of national significance because the race riot that happened in 1908 right here in beautiful downtown Springfield was the catalyst for the formation of the NAACP, the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, which is the oldest civil rights organization in the nation.
So there are currently historical markers in downtown Springfield sort of detailing where different events took place, mm-hmm. which have been recently updated.
Right.
How is this site different than those historical markers?
Thanks to the archaeological work that was done by Floyd Mansberger and Chris Stratton, we are able to see the remnants of where some of the actual events occurred, the foundations of the burned out houses that were in the neighborhood that was pretty much destroyed during the race riot.
Is that a different experience than just reading it on a plaque for you?
Oh, without a doubt, because it's kind of like if you close your eyes, you can probably imagine what it would have been like to have been in that neighborhood at that time to have those horrific events occur. And you're right there in the midst of it.
And so if we can back up, if you wouldn't mind just describing what actually took place in 1908.
The 1908 race riot was started because Mabel Hallam, a white woman, told a lie that she was raped by a black man. Two black men were in jail, the supposed rapist and another man. Were in jail, and the residents of Springfield, when they heard about it, they wanted to extract their own vengeance. Instead of waiting for a trial or anything, they ran amok. They just went wild and destroyed the neighborhood called the Levee and the Badlands, the Levee being the business district where the African Americans, for the most part, had their businesses, and the Badlands, where many African Americans lived, and just destroyed that area. And people ran and feared for their lives, and two people were lynched, Scott Burton, who was a barber, and an 84-year-old man whose name was William Donegan. It's just difficult to imagine the level of hatred that must have been present in those folks to do that.
The study that the National Park Service did noted that one of the reasons that the Springfield race riot got national attention was because of Springfield.
Because of where it was.
Right.
In the home of the great emancipator. It was a black spot on Mr. Lincoln's hometown.
Talk a little bit more about that connection and its relevance today.
There's still work to do. We can't rest on our laurels because our city was responsible for the formation of the NAACP. The race riot wasn't even talked about, hardly. It was swept under the rug, literally, for many years.
How would you like to see the historic monument site, if it comes to be? How would you like to see it interpreted?
You have to tell the story because you have to include all the wards. So the story has to be told, but then you have to see the good that came out of it, which is the formation of the NAACP, which has always been an integrated organization because its founders were black and white.
What else do you think it's important for people to remember about that event and why it's relevant now?
I think it's also good to know that Springfield acknowledged, when I say Springfield acknowledged, I mean the city founders, did acknowledge that this occurred, issued an apology, and have made not only through the markers that are here, but we have in the cemetery gravestones for Donegan and Burton. And it might sound hackney and corny, but lest we forget, I don't think we ever want to see things like that happen again. But moving into today, you think about Charlottesville. At least I think about Charlottesville. And people walking around with tiki torches, and I didn't see good people on both sides. I think W.E.B. Du Bois said, or someone said, that the problem of the 20th century is the problem of the color line. But it wouldn't be a problem if there was acknowledgement and honest discussion about how we got here in the first place.
And do you feel like the national monument potential for that plays a role?
I certainly think it does, and I certainly hope that it will.
That's Catherine Harris talking with our reporter, Mary Hansen. A growing number of Illinois church congregations are being forced to make a once unthinkable decision, either change locations or disband altogether. But moving out doesn't always mean the end. And for this week's Illinois Issues report, Sam Dunklaw examined a few churches to find out what's behind the decline. He also found life goes on for places of worship long after the last service.
It's a hot day in the city of Jacksonville, about 40 minutes west of Springfield. I'm here checking out an unassuming red brick church. Lots of towns have them, but this one is different. I've met a woman here who was in charge of the place for a while.
Hi, Pastor. How are you?
She prefers I call her Jean.
My name is Jean Hembro.
Because she's a retired minister, and the church where we've met, the Brooklyn United Methodist Church, well, isn't an active church. At least, not anymore. That's because it closed 2 years ago.
When they closed, their average Sunday attendance was somewhere between 10 and 15.
For context, Centenary United Methodist Church, just across town, has a congregation at least 10 times that number. A lot of factors combined over the years and led to the smaller church's closure. Members were aging faster than youth could replace them, and maintenance costs for the building soared. Hembro says she's specially trained to deal with church closures, but doing it wasn't easy.
It was somewhat of a heartache, as everybody could see that the church was declining and that eventually it would probably have to close, and that was very difficult.
But even though its last service was held 2 years ago, life has gone on for the Brooklyn United Methodist Church. It's now used as a youth ministry center for another church in Jacksonville. This tale of two churches scenario has been playing out all over Illinois and around the country. It's true, houses of worship from southern Illinois to Chicago have been shuttering, and national studies have shown church membership has been falling over the last few decades. But when a congregation leaves, a sacred building story may be only just beginning.
So even though they may be shrinking, many of them are, that doesn't necessarily mean that they will end up closing.
This is Bob Yeager. He's the president of the nonprofit Partners for Sacred Places. He says while fewer people are attending worship services, there's a growing movement to keep sacred buildings a part of the community, even if it's in a different form. Yeager's counterpart at the National Fund for Sacred Places, Chad Martin, agrees.
When religious life is changing and the ways that people connect with each other on a human level is changing, is there a way for these buildings to continue to be seen as real icons of the community?
That idea is at the center of a movement to repurpose, rather than demolish, churches that close their doors. To see this movement in action, just visit downtown Springfield. A round limestone and brick church sits at a busy intersection. It's where the city's first United Methodist congregation once met. But now it's an apartment building and the headquarters for the Springfield Area Chamber of Commerce. Chris Hembro, who runs the chamber, took me on a tour.
Well, as you can see the space that's available, it's turned out fantastic.
You can tell it was a church. There's stained glass everywhere with new carpeting to match. The original doors and features from the sanctuary are still there. Hembro says he's happy the developer did two things at once.
They want to see that it maintained some of the integrity of the facility, but secondly, that the facility was repurposed and in use again rather than sitting here empty as it had for the last 10 years.
And as for the Methodist congregation that moved out, they're still around on Springfield's west side. Sharon Sweeney is the director of connections there. She says while some members still pine for the old place, she's happy it's no longer sitting empty.
And if this is something that can give it life and bring the community together downtown, I was all for it.
Springfield's church project is just one of many. In Peoria, Khan's Hospitality Group went to work repurposing a church-turned-Masonic hall into a restaurant, a sort of beer church. Karen Khan is CEO of the company.
If it's not for somebody like us, it's half crazy to take on a structure this large. Chances are that there could be a strong possibility that it would have been demolished.
It's easy to look at the decline of sacred places through a lens of good or bad, but folks close to the matter say otherwise.
A congregation can totally exist without a building. And as you're seeing, the buildings can have a life of their own that exists, like, well beyond the life of the congregation.
I'm Sam Dunklaw.
You can read more of that story and also see photos at our website at statewideshow.com. And that wraps up this week's Statewide. You can join us again at this time next week for more reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. And again, our website, statewideshow.com. If you missed any of this show or past episodes, they're all available there. You can also drop us a line or email address available on the site. Our weekly podcast can be found through the NPR One app. I'm Sean Crawford. Statewide is a production of NPR Illinois with help from other Illinois public radio stations.